And then I'd ask that you please help me to welcome Tom W. from Oakland as our speaker tonight.
I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic from Oakland, California, and I'm glad to be here. Sal told me to talk about him for the whole time, just so you know. And I've known Lee for ever so long. Lee first asked me to come and talk in the prison, and I thought that was a wonderful thing, and I'm glad to come down to this part of the world. I've had friends here. On the way driving down, Johnny and Phyllis Kalman moved into this part of the world. Tom and Joan Bowles were in this part of the world. And those were all people I loved very, very much. And one of my classmates is down here now. He's working at a parish in the neighborhood. And I think all that's good news. So I'm glad to be here. Some of you I've met before, and others seem to be very brand new. So the way it works is I get to talk about my stuff, and this is how the program seems to work. A lot of us don't do well if we're lectured to, or if we're yelled at, or if we're preached at. Now, those things don't seem to work for us, but if someone shares their story, some people relate. And it's even in the very text of the book, which I'll use a couple times tonight. They'll say, there's the first 164 pages, but then there's a whole bunch of stories. And I want you to know, I've been sober a long time. On more than one occasion, the stories in the back saved my butt. And where the first 164 pages bored me to tears. But if I got a couple of the stories in the back of the book, it made a difference. And it says in the text, we know you are unique, special, and different. We know you are better than everyone else and worse than everyone else at the same time. And that no one knows the trouble you've seen. We all know that. But we're going to give you 42 completely different stories. And we hope you can hear one of them. Interesting. It doesn't say you're going to identify with most. We hope you identify with one of them. And if you can say, yes, that happened to me, good news. If you can say, oh, I felt like that, better news, because it's a deeper identification. And if you can say, I think this program might work for me too, it's very good news. And when it opens up, it's right after, it's the very start of the stories in the back. And it's written down so I don't have to have this memorized. It says, here's a whole bunch of stories. Part one, Pioneers of AA. This group of 10 stories shows that sobriety in AA can be lasting. That was just not believed. Once a drunk, always a drunk. There's no way out. There was a big movement in the 1800s called the Washingtonians. It was very exciting. It was very popular. I think even Mr. Lincoln on one occasion talked to a Washingtonians group. They had no program of recovery whatsoever. But they were very enthusiastic, and they'd get you sober for about 9 days, and then they'd have you speak. And you were to speak about how awful it was, because there was no recovery, and it was better than TV. And you could rent auditoriums, and people would come and hear the Washingtonians speak. But it was a lot of drama and excitement. But a lot of them didn't stay sober, because there was no program. And then the Civil War happened, like COVID, and changed everything. So the Washingtonians kind of disappeared. They stopped in Dr. Bob's story, it says, and this is, as I write this, nearly 4 years have passed. And people responded with, wow, 4 years. Part two, they stopped in time. 17 stories may help you decide whether you are alcoholic. Semicolon. Also, whether AA is for you. Because we're not for everybody. We're a very odd culture. And to say, oh, Saturday night, let's go to Orcutt and hang out and not drink, a lot of people wouldn't find that interesting. But if you have a particular kind of brain weirdness, you'd look forward to something like this, you know, when you'd come. But it's not for everybody. I just think that's important to say. There are lots of different ways people handle things. There are lots of different ways people stay dry. I think we have much more fun than they do. I remember I had some interaction with a priest who was not drinking, went through treatment, full of shame. And I talked with him some years later, and he just said, please don't make me go to those awful meetings. Now, this was one of the most unhappy men in North America. But he didn't want to go to those awful meetings, so he gets to be unhappy. Part three, they lost nearly all. Those who believe their drinking to be hopeless may again find hope in these 15 impressive tales. The last 15 stories in the book are stories of people who thought they were hopeless. And I love those stories. I love those stories. So with that as introduction, I'm going to talk about some of my stuff. If there's anything I say that's helpful, please use it. And if it's not helpful, don't worry about it. I am surely not everybody's cup of tea. And you get to like some people and not like some people and all that. I grew up in San Jose, California. I remember orchards. And my dad worked he was the superintendent of the cannery for 40 years. So he knew every farmer in the Santa Clara Valley. And he was an extroverted fellow who interacted with people very, very well, drank a little, but had a lot going on for him. Irish family, his parents were right from the old country. My father's father was one of the gardeners at Stanford University for 40 years, back when the Irish were the day laborers, you know, who took care of the yards and did the cooking and all the stuff that now you have to speak Spanish for. But 100 years ago, you know, it was my people. My mom, she was from Sweden. She was a direct immigrant, and she came over here, and they got married in 1934. They ran off to Reno, and they ran off on Friday, and both came back to work on Monday because they both had jobs, and it was 1934. So these are serious people. These are not frivolous people. My mom worked to be an accountant for years and years, and my dad studied engineering and thought like an engineer. My experience of them was prison. There's no air, there's no freedom, I can't stand it. And I was the youngest, and I found it very difficult to live with my parents. I know you don't identify with that at all, right? Anyway, alcohol really helped in 100 different ways. I found it fun. I found it charming. I found it delicious. I found it exciting. I found it dangerous. All those things that I liked a lot. I remember as a kid playing with booze, taking creme de menthe right out of the bottle, you know, green sugar. But your mouth is green, so you can't do that a lot. Evidence. I remember taking a mouthful of bourbon, the liquor bottles were on the floor, a mouthful of bourbon, and then going to the refrigerator and getting a mouthful of Hershey syrup. And I'll tell you, when you're 11, that's delicious. And in fancier places, they're called Brandy Alexanders. But I knew, you know, right away. I did a tequila milkshake on one occasion, which is awful. And I drank the whole thing. I don't think I did that twice, but I drank the whole thing. And in high school, I got my driver's license at 16, and I was driving badly within seconds. And I didn't have to drink to drive like an idiot, but I'm a drunk driver. I heard my sponsor talk about that once. He said, "My name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drunk driver." And then he paused and said, "That means I was willing to kill you." And the scariest part of my story is the drunk driving. I never killed anybody. I was stopped once crossing the Bay Bridge from San Francisco. I was living in Berkeley. Cops pulled me over and said, "Where are you headed?" And I said, "Home. Where's home? Berkeley." He said, "Get home." And I did. Let's pause for a second. I was just at the Department of Motor Vehicles to renew my driver's license. I just turned 77, so these are the big numbers. And you have to show up. And I've been to this DMV a whole bunch of times. But this time, I've been sober for a while, and I was very anxious about this. I don't know if you get anxious, but I get anxious. And I got the notice in the mail that my license needed to be renewed, and I was so anxious I lost that notice. I didn't want to know about it. But the clock was ticking, and every so often I'd be reminded of, oh no! And so I went online, and you can get California driver's tests online, and you take them and take them and take them. And to get ready for that, I took 30 or 40 or 50 of them because I'm anxious. And then I just showed up at the DMV Tuesday morning without an appointment. It opened at 8:00. There were like 30 people ahead of me. And I was aware, I turned it all over. This is a step 1, 2, 3 story. I turned it all over, asked God for help. And what I was aware of was how anxious I was. And before I went in through the doors, I just said, "God, help me." Went in through the doors, looked around, and what I noticed, everybody's anxious here. This is a place of high anxiety. And I went to the nice man, one of the bureaucrats, and that's his job. He has a job of helping run things. "What are you here for?" "Driver's license." He gave me some directions. I followed them. And I interacted with 4 or 5 or 6 of the bureaucrats that worked there. Every interaction was humane and decent and friendly. I think they've all gone to Al-Anon, is what they've done. They've learned how to act rather than react, and don't make it worse, and easy does it, and leave the poor person alone. And I went through all the stuff, and I got my picture taken, and then the man said, and I'm anxious. I thought he said, "Do you want to take the exam?" Which might mean I don't have to take the exam, right? Can I say no? But he said it really fast, and I think he also could have said, "Are you ready to take the exam?" So I just said, "Okay," and I went and I took the exam, and there were a couple of questions I had never seen before. You can say I'd rather not answer this one. I skipped one or two. I got a couple of wrong. I did not know how many questions they were going to be asking. You know, was it 25 or 50 or 75? And so, and all of a sudden they said, "You passed." I passed. And then I went over to do something else, and the guy gave me my renewal, and I left, and I was just full of gratitude, and I reflected on the experience. And I said, I was aware of my anxiety, and I kept breathing the whole time and watching people. And instead of shutting down and running through blindly, I walked through it calmly, and it took 1 hour and 25 minutes. I was expecting 6 days of misery standing in line because I'm not an optimist. There was a young man there who looked very freaked out. And he was standing next to me, and I just said to him, "Breathe. Breathe. Breathe." And breathing really helps. And I find with me and anxiety, if I'm caught by surprise, I hold my breath. And then oxygen does not get to the brain. And then I can behave very badly. So That's happened more than once. So the DMV. I'm grateful for that. And I'm a daily drinker. I'm a drunk driver. When I was 18 years old, I ran away from home and joined the circus. And it was called the Jesuit Order. And we're teachers. We're teachers, and I wanted to be a teacher, and I wanted to be a high school teacher, and I did that for a long time. And my I was in school for a lot. I had to study things like philosophy and theology, none of which are that interesting, just between us. But there were other things I found interesting, and I read them and studied them, and I learned a little Spanish and a little of this and a little of that, and went through school, and I was pretty much surrounded by wonderful people. And I drank. Every so often I pause and look at my relationship with alcohol. Dr. Gill, who's been gone now 10 plus years, Gill would say alcoholism, the three stages, fun plus problems. And step one asks the question, are you still having any fun? And if you are, we don't look good to you. I mean, I'm still enjoying myself very much. Leave me alone. If I ever need you, I'll call you. You know, I mean, I've had that conversation. But I did a little different reflection. And when I was in school, you study systematic theology, and you study church history, and you study scripture, and you study pastoral stuff, which has to do with people in crisis, and people get into all kinds of problems. And so we would read about dysfunctional families, but violent families, and the phenomenon of one spouse beating up another, the other spouse, and then the beaten up spouse, once they heal and stop bleeding, goes back. And then they get beaten up again, and they stop bleeding, and they go back. And they go back, which is pretty crazy. And that was my relationship with alcohol. It would treat me really bad, and I couldn't leave it alone. It was my best friend, even though it was killing me. It was my lover. It was my focus of attention, even though it was killing me. And I could not let go. But it almost killed you, but I love it, you know? So there's a craziness there that I'm newly aware of. I remember it worked for such a long time. When I was teaching, and I taught in Los Angeles at Loyola High School, which is right now in Koreatown. That's where I taught. And I remember I taught 3 years drinking and 4 years sober. And it's easier to teach kids when you're drinking. I would just like to say that. Other teachers in the room, we can match notes on that. But this, in a couple of weeks, the 50th reunion of some kids I taught in the 1970s is happening, and I'm going to go down to it. And I go to some of the reunions. And for driver's license, this was the first time when they said color of hair, I put in white instead of gray, white, back to high school reunions. I went to one for some kids I taught, and the kids I loved, they were these 17-year-old goofy kids. Now they're all grandparents, you know, getting Social Security. It's that long ago. But I was sitting there, and I sat down with one of the other teachers, a guy who taught math. I taught history. I didn't talk to math people. And we were sitting next to this guy, and this guy has been teaching at the school a long time, and we had a polite little visiting conversation. And he said, can I talk to you for just a minute? And I said, sure. He said, I know you're a sober person. And I think that's really exciting. But when I was a brand new teacher, first year, and I was a veteran teacher, you came into the teacher's room one morning, and I was getting my class all ready, and you sat down next to me and pulled out a cigarette and said a very bad vulgar word. And then you said, I have to teach in 20 minutes and I'm still drunk. And he said, you scared me to death. And I just stayed away from you for the rest of the year. Now, I do not remember that, but I don't doubt it for a second. Alcohol. I didn't drink in the morning. I was still drunk from the night before. And I remember some of those awful days with awful children and hot and miserable. And I'd get to the house. We lived in the Jesuit community there and drinks at five. And I would get there and get a water glass and throw some ice in there and fill it up. Vodka was just fine. Gin was fine. Bourbon was fine. Did not trust Scotch drinkers. And I would gulp it down in two or three gulps, and I would feel instantly better. Oh, thank God, I could breathe. So let's do it again. And you fill it up and drink it down. Oh, I'm alive for the first time all day. And then drink number three. I can nurse the third one, but the day has begun. And I've been out of bed for hours, you know, but the day has finally begun. Thank you, alcohol. It really worked for a long time. One of the women in the East Bay where I got sober, her name was Phoebe. I heard her say this over 40 years ago. Alcohol did something for me, and then alcohol did something to me. It's like the lover that betrays you, you know? It's not supposed to end like this, right? Oh, my goodness. I'm really happy with all the birthdays and anniversaries. And this is from the book. I was somewhere in Texas in early January. And if you know, if you travel around and go to meetings in different places, you bump into different parts of the book. My group reads this page. Well, there's a lot of pages. And this is from The Medical View on AA, page 570. Dr. W.W. Bauer, broadcasting under the auspices of the American Medical Association in 1946, the year before I was born, over the NBC network, said in part, quote, Alcoholics Anonymous are not crusaders. They are not a temperance society. They know that they must never drink. They help others with similar problems. In this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself, like Sal. Learning to depend upon a higher power and absorb himself in his work with other alcoholics, he remains sober day by day. The days add up into weeks, the weeks into months and years. I don't reach out for help. I think if I have to ask for help, it's embarrassing. If you have a problem, you are a problem. So a lot of my drinking was furtive, sneaky. No one knew the whole story. I drank by myself a lot. I could be a very social person for a short period of time, and then I had to go and finish the job. I was a successful drinker for a long time as a high school kid. I would drink and I was just full of energy and I could talk to girls and dance. I mean, it was a miracle substance. And then I would get confidence with alcohol and sophisticated with alcohol and insightful with alcohol, all that stuff. Fun plus problems. By the time I got to Berkeley in 1974, I thought I was going crazy. There's that The second step talks about being restored to sanity. And what I was becoming more aware of is how I could not guarantee my behavior after the first drink. The drunk driving, but some of my behavior was increasingly erratic and crazy. One of our students, my student, came up to Berkeley freshman year, I guess. I'd been there maybe 2 years, and he lived on the south side of campus, I on the north side. And I went over to his apartment for dinner one night with another one of his former teachers. And his name was Charlie, and he brought out a bottle of vodka. I later find out both of his parents were in the program. But he knew that I needed help. Bottle of vodka. My friend had a drink. I drank the whole bottle. It is fine with me. I don't mind evenings like that. I am having such a good time, and I'll have another drink, and thank you very much. And I was hilarious and insightful. Hit the cold night air and blackout. So the next morning, waking up hungover, called my friend who was with me, and I said, what happened last night? Now, my friend, we had taught together at the same school. We'd known each other since we were kids. He was very concerned. His dad was a Teamster in San Francisco, and his dad's best friend was the Teamster who was in charge of all the alcoholic Teamsters in San Francisco. If you could imagine that as a job, anyway, he was the guy. So my friend talked to his dad's friend about me. And the thing of having an intervention came up, and one of the things you're told, if you're going to do that kind of preparation, is to take notes. If the alcoholic behaves very badly, take notes. So you just don't say, you didn't behave well last night. See, that doesn't give any information. This happened, that happened. That you want to take notes. So my friend was following the suggestion. Jerry, what happened last night? And he asked an Al-Anon trick question. What's the last thing you remember? And I said, well, leaving Charlie's apartment. And he said, oh, well, let's start with the police. And then he just went down the list. Evidently, I got very animated on Telegraph Avenue and started getting angry at authority figures and threatened to kill the boss. And who doesn't? And then I was going to take a rock and throw it through one of those big plate glass windows. And the Berkeley police intervened, and they were going to take me in for observation, and my friend, who had not yet been to Al-Anon, said, oh, officers, I'll walk him home. And that was from that point across campus. It's a 15 to 20 minute walk. It took him 3 hours to get me there because I got very excited, and I decided I would take off all my clothes. And people needed warning about General Franco, Spain, and the Nixon White House. There were links there that people hadn't seen, and I had to warn them. So I was totally nuts. Jerry picked up my clothes, followed me, got me home, threw me in my room, and got to bed. So the next morning, when I thought it was a pretty innocent question, you know, what happened last night. When he went down the list, several things happened to me internally. Number one, I didn't doubt any of this. Oh, you're making it up. None of this. The thought of going crazy was clearer. And the decision I made was I can no longer drink with witnesses. I'm gonna drink by myself from now on because it's not worth the misery. And I go into this period of publicly not drinking but drinking, and then I did, because I was scared and a few other things, I think I went I went dry for a little while, and I'm not drinking, and it's all I could do was not drink. We have classes and stuff, but I'm just not drinking. And I went for a couple of weeks, a couple of months, something like that, and it was just awful. I'd wake up not drinking, and I'd have breakfast not drinking, I'd go to class not drinking, take a siesta not drinking, dinner not drinking, watch Walter Cronkite. That's the way it is. And I would have 5 more hours of not drinking. And I would stay awake till the end of the day and cross another day off the calendar. This is called obsession. Obsession. Not happy, joyous, and free. And we were invited to go to the Episcopal School, Church Divinity School of the Pacific, that's for the Episcopal Church. We were invited to attend a social over there. Let's get together. We're all living in Berkeley. So we went, and I had no intention of drinking. I'm not drinking. And my friend was standing next to me, and one of the Episcopal seminarians came around with a tray with sherry on. These are Episcopalians. Sherry, you know, with fruit. And a toothpick. I mean, it's not my drink. I am not interested at all. And as this nice seminarian's walking by with the tray with sherry, my friend turns to me and says, "You can't have any of that." I reached out, I grabbed one. I slammed it down, maybe I did too. I had to leave the social situation. I got a bottle of bourbon and, to quote Dr. Bob, went to my room to finish the job. So I had to hide my drinking. I did iced tea and vodka for a while. And my friends, even though they're college graduates, aren't that bright. And I would fall down drunk, and they would say, "How did he get drunk? He was just drinking iced tea." They also didn't know that scotch and milk actually go very nicely together. Lot of things. So I got intervened on. We had a new boss, and we had taught together in the school, and so he knew me pretty well. And I was in trouble. And I got called into the imperial presence. And, you're 29. You're really in trouble with your drinking. Treatment is a good idea. I've already been to therapy. Treatment's a good idea. And I said, "What about AA? And he said, "Do that too." So this was a Wednesday. My first day without a drink was the day that Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States. You can look that up. Wednesday, August, Republican Convention, 1976. The big ships, New York Harbor, bicentennial, third edition of the big book, Gerald Ford, and I get sober. And I called AA. "Is there a meeting anywhere in the Bay Area this weekend? I didn't know anything about you." Friday night in Oakland, there's a meeting. They did not tell me it was an old-timers meeting. And it was, 10, 20 people, all of them around 300 years old. And I come and sit at the table, and I bring a book with me, because I always bring a book. If you bring a book, they leave you alone. And I sat there, and they were happy and, glad to be there, and it's Friday night, and oh, man. It was my turn, and I'm a quick study. My name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. "Hi, Tom," which is very aggressive. If you've been a little isolated for a couple of months, that's very aggressive. And then I told these extremely old people that I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night, which was beer, which doesn't really count, you know, for alcohol. Two pitchers of beer in the pizza parlor in Santa Clara. How humiliating. I've heard some great last drink stories, you know. You're in a fancy hotel and you're having a rusty nail and you're talking to elegant people and you have a little blackout. And 6 months later, you come out of the blackout and you're in a motel room in Rio de Janeiro with $600,000 worth of cocaine and a dead body in the room. So you call AA. I love those stories. It's so not my story. If I had known that was going to be my last drink, I would have done this very differently. Beer. So when I told these people with whom I had nothing in common that I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night, they burst into applause. I could not have been more surprised. I mean, because isn't this shameful? I mean, this should be an embarrassing, shameful thing, not something you celebrate. But I've learned this is something we celebrate. You know, is there anyone in their first 30 days? Anyone in their first week? And our response is joy. And they clapped. I was embarrassed. I lost all my words. But what I knew was I have finally met a group of people who know what it means to not have a drink since Tuesday night. Miracle. I didn't fall in love with AA that night, but I knew there was a place I could go. And the guy next to me, I thought I was the youngest person in the room. This guy was younger, a couple years. Named Gary, worked in a gas station in Alameda, Vietnam, Special Forces. Big, tough guy. Did some time inside. Because when he would drink, he'd make bad, violent choices. Gary said to me, "We here in Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. And we don't use no dope." Well, those were three completely new ideas to me. Going to lots of meetings, what does that even mean? You know? I was in graduate school. You have a couple of classes a week. I'd go a couple of times a month. That's a lot of meetings. We go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. If I go to a meeting a day, this might be easier. And we don't use no dope. I had been smoking non-habit forming marijuana every day for 10 years. It's not addictive. I use it every day. And I loved it, but I have no secrets from you. I never learned how to roll a joint. I am so ashamed. I never learned the papers and all. I had friends who could roll a joint while driving, one hand, and I was so impressed with it. Look at, you know, I love you. I smoked it in a corncob pipe like Douglas MacArthur and felt rather patriotic about this. But I love it. Also, I should add, part of my complaint through all of my 20s was fighting depression. And I was consuming depressants on a daily basis for years. Booze and marijuana. Now this is an opinion and it's an outside issue. If you suffer from depression and you're taking an antidepressant, it makes no sense to drink at all. You're fighting depression. That's liquid depression. Why are you taking it? You're not an alcoholic, but you're depressed and clearly stupid. Mm-hmm. Oh, well. We legalized marijuana in California a few years ago, and one of my sponsees called me very excited and said, marijuana is legal now. And I said, beer has been legal since 1933. Legality is not the issue. The way it seems to be for so many of us, if you're a drunk who smokes a lot of dope, if you continue smoking dope, you'll go back to drinking. That seems to be the pattern for most of us. So I don't smoke because I don't want to drink again. I never did pills very much at all. I'm very grateful for that. I saw a therapist at the end of my drinking, Dr. Arthur Solomon in San Francisco, because I wanted to get a Valium prescription because a lot of my friends were on Valium and they seemed calmer. And I asked him if I could get Valium and he said no. And I said, why not? He said, you'd abuse it. I said, well, exactly what I'd like to do is use alcohol and Valium to find the right balance, you know. And I mentioned that story because we need to know there are therapists who know what they're doing. And some of us shouldn't be on Valium. I have done Valium a couple of times. I think I've stolen it a couple of times. And a couple of friends have helped me by giving me their, you know, take one. And I never fell in love with it. Because it takes 20 minutes. Who has that kind of time? What's nice about alcohol is it's instant redemption. I can, thank God. So I went to treatment and I started going to meetings and I did a whole bunch of things. I was supposed to be ordained a priest that spring of 77, and it was held up for a year because you shouldn't make a major change in your life for your first year. And so I was ordained instead in 1978 on April 1st, a perfectly good date. And I took it like a third step. This is a way of turning things over into God's care. Let's see what happens. It was a very happy day. And I went back to teach, and I found it really difficult. Although I was a very successful teacher while drinking, I was a very successful teacher. Going back to the classroom, I had nothing but anxiety. I doubted myself. I didn't know if I could handle the kids. I didn't know if I knew anything. I didn't know if I had any vocabulary left. It was real hard work. I think my second year sober, my first year back in the classroom, was the hardest year of my life. I moved to Los Angeles. And in 1977, there were 1,000 meetings a week in Los Angeles County. Now there's 4,000 because of the resentment level. And I started, you get this meeting book, and I started going to meetings, and where do you find a good meeting? I wrote the Archbishop, and I said, I'm coming down to your part of the world, and if there's a sober priest, I'd like to meet him. And he wrote back and said, when you get to town, call Father Terry Ritchie, Father Terry R., who got sober in 1971. And he became my sponsor, and he was my sponsor for 45 years. Died in December 2022, dementia and exhausted and 84 years old and almost 53 years sober. So what happens when your sponsor has dementia? He knew he was forgetful. And we'd notice he'd repeat himself, tell the same joke 3 times in an hour. And he went with his sister to get a brain thing. And they took pictures, and the short-term memory part was pretty dark. And they said, well, this is, his mom had dementia. You know, this, something's going on here, and we can help you a little bit, but this is a process. And Terry went to a meeting and he said, I'm Terry, I'm an alcoholic and I'm losing my mind. Ha, ha, ha. He said, I have a picture. So he showed them. And when we heard about that, we his sponsees went, now what do we do? Freak, 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 freak. And I found this to be true. Number one, he was not ashamed of this. He was not angry about this. He was not embarrassed about this. He could talk about this because he has a program of recovery where truth-telling is such a big deal. You don't have to pretend about anything. He and I did a couple of retreats together for people in recovery, and he'd go 20 minutes, I'd go 20 minutes, and we're very different, but it worked really well together. And then he flew from L.A. to San Francisco. I met him at the airport. I'll meet you at baggage claim. And then we went to my house. He slept there that night. And Friday morning, he came in to have coffee. And he said, where am I? And I said, you're at my house. I thought so, but I just need to check. And then we went and had a really wonderful weekend. He gave very good talks. His stuff, program, heart, very, very full. And then he went back to Los Angeles, and he needed a paper ticket. Electronic tickets don't exist. Paper tickets are real. And he'd get to the gate, and then his sister met him at baggage claim. And a couple of weeks later, I said, that was really wonderful. Do you want to do that again? And he says, no. He said, I'm not going to travel anymore, and I'm not going to do retreats anymore. This is a decision I want to make for myself. I don't want someone to make this decision for me. Okay. One-on-one, he was right with me. If there were a couple of us in the room having conversations, he couldn't follow it. If I gave him three or four things to talk about, he got lost. One, he was right with me. So we went to the International Convention in Atlanta. And his friends in L.A., there was always someone with him, so he didn't get lost. Give newcomers something to do. Keep an eye on Father Terry. And I was in crisis. I had a disagreement with my boss. I got stranded at O'Hare Airport. Six other things were wrong. I was upset. I was feeling feelings, all of which were unhappy ones. And I get to Atlanta and there's Terry and I have to talk to you. And there's this young person there. He said, well, you don't have to leave. I said, this is all public. And then I just spewed out all this stuff. This is wrong and that's wrong. And I'm not getting along with the boss and this and that and this and that and so forth. And Terry listened and then he said, why should you be any different? Everybody feels jerked around sometimes. You're not different. You get to get your nose out of joint. Welcome. This is called being alive. Which was the perfectly right answer to give me. Why should you be any different? For the years we were together, he would tell me to identify rather than compare, identify rather than compare, identify rather than compare, because that's not my first instinct. I asked him once on one of his good days, this is, you know, years before the dementia came in, even without dementia, sponsors have good days and bad days, I've noticed that. So when your sponsor's having a good day, take advantage of that. You know, you want to ask him big questions. And I asked him, so what's God's will? And he said, it is God's will for each of us to have a life. Go get one. Which means you try things, you know? And you see what fits, and you do this, and you do that, and you make mistakes, and that's how we learn. I was done teaching kids. I didn't like them anymore. I didn't like their music. I didn't like their anything. I remember at this time, this is late 70s, There was a band called Devo. We are not men, we are Devo. And one of the kids thought it was brilliant music, the most brilliant music he ever heard, and it was changing the universe. And I was an adult male in my 30s. I was arguing with a high school boy about Devo. They're crap. Why do you listen to them? And as I was yelling at this kid about this awful music, it occurred to me that I was the crazy one. Kids get to like crap. I mean, I did. I don't have to be the angry adult yelling at kids because they're on my lawn. And that's kind of where I was. So it was clear I needed to leave the classroom. And I there were a couple of other options, and I didn't know what to do. And I asked Terry, "What do you do? What should I do?" And he said, "Well, write down the pros and cons, pros and cons, pros and cons." And then we met, and I showed him the manuscript. And he barely looked at it. I thought he was going to study it and weigh it and, you know, come up with the conclusion. And I said, "So what should I do? Stay or leave, or stay or leave, or stay?" And he said, "Well, what you've shown for the last 4 years is you can stay clean and sober with a very highly stressful, highly organized job with bells ringing all day long. High school kid work. It is heroic work. It's where the rubber meets the road, and very special people do it, and you've been doing it for 4 years staying sober. Your new job, which would be in West Oakland doing some social work, there's no rules at all. You'll be on the street, you'll be doing a lot of stuff. You'll be inventing it as you go along. It's all new. So the question is, do you want to see if you can develop your sobriety up there?" But what should I do? What do we pay you people for? And he said, "You can do either one. It can only be a terrible mistake. You have made many terrible mistakes to get here. You'll continue making many terrible mistakes as you live here. And when you're wrong, you promptly admit it and go do something else." And that was one of our better conversations in 40 years of having conversations. I still have defects of character. I just want you to know that. When I was 20, I took a week off and I went to a Benedictine monastery in New Mexico. I mean, that's like a movie. And I was going to read the book and chant with the monks. And I read the stories in the back. Where's this one? This one is called, "He Sold Himself Short." It's the one of the first guys from Chicago to get sober. And you might know that there are some terrible alcoholics in Chicago. I was at a meeting in the Water Tower District years ago, noontime. And they read, you know, traditions and stuff and things in chapter 5. And then before the meeting got started, there was a guy with a 3x5 card. And he said, "This is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything you say here can and will be used against you in a court of law." Because a guy sharing at a meeting thought that he might possibly have been involved in a murder. He wasn't quite sure, but he had a couple of ideas. And he was involved in a murder, and someone connected him with the police department, and there was a trial, and he went to jail. "But I said it at an AA meeting." The law, she doesn't care. Some things are not for group discussion, you know? Like, "I'd like to discuss my medical practice with you." Don't do that, you know? Should I be taking... It's not for group discussion. Talk to a real doctor who's been to school, you know? Goodness. So this guy in Chicago gets to Akron. Akron and Chicago, it's like Oakland to LA. It's 6-7 hours. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, it was Dr. Bob's afternoon off. He had me to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the six-step program as it was at that time. This is on page 263 in the fourth edition. The six steps were, 1, complete deflation, 2, dependence and guidance from a higher power, 3, moral inventory, 4, confession, 5, restitution, 6, continued work with other alcoholics. Now, Bill will take those and turn them into 12. And be met with outrage for changing the program. He'll be yelled at for ruining the program. 6 are fine, why 12? It was very unhappy there in New York when he announced the 12 steps. Dr. Bob led me through all these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought up several of my bad personality traits. So it's this guy's inventory, but Dr. Bob's doing the talking. Have you ever wanted to do that with someone you sponsor? You know, before you even begin your fourth step, can I mention a few things I've noticed? He brought up several of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as, now when I did my fourth step, resentments, fear, sexual stuff, money, things that made Bill Wilson's life crazy. Here's Dr. Bob's list. Selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment. Selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment. Now, these jumped off the page when I was 20 years sober because these are mine. And I kept thinking, I should be so much better by now, you know? I mean, really. So I went home and I called Terry. And I said, I've asked to have these removed. Why do I still have them? And he said, we ask to have them removed. We do not ask to have them erased. They're removed. Attic, back room, basement. And they stay there until I'm out of balance. Until I'm too hungry, too angry, too lonely, too tired. When I suddenly have an outrageous flare of, you know, my dignity. And these defects of character hook up in groups of 2 and 3 and come right and center. And I behave badly, and then I have to promptly admit when I'm wrong and clean up the mess. That's been true for me for the last 27 years, just so you know. I continue having difficulty with all of these. Fear stuff. I'm less able to distract myself from fear. Stairs frighten me. Falling frightens me. Losing balance frightens me. The DMV frightens me. Airports, I fly a lot. People in airports are very anxious people. And just saying that, this is in the last year. I'm home. Nothing particular is going on. There is no emergency. And I'm kind of looking at my brain, and the thought comes that I should buy a bottle of bourbon, I should buy a gun, I should go to an AA meeting, I should drink the bottle of bourbon in the parking lot, go into the meeting, and shoot myself. When I got to the part of shooting myself in an AA meeting, I paused and said, I think I'm angry about something. I have no idea what I'm angry about because I'm not feeling anything, but the thinking is so angry. So at 47 years sober, and a priest for, I don't know, 48 years, what do you do? Well, don't keep this secret. I made 2 phone calls immediately and told 2 of my friends, went downstairs, another guy in my community is in the program, and I just said, this just went on. And of course, everyone said, oh yeah, that's right, and that happens. It'll pass, don't worry about it. And you gonna see you at a meeting tonight? Not emergency room, electroshock therapy. Ah! No, it's just this is how alcoholics think on slow Thursday afternoons. Why don't you just shoot yourself? So I thought, I'm gonna mention this when I talk in large groups because and I did this in a men's group in Marin, a men's group in Marin County. Oy. You have to cross a bridge to get there. It's very intense in Marin County. And two guys came up and said, thank you for mentioning that. I thought I was the only person who had that thought, and I felt so ashamed. Well, I have a very active imaginary life. So anyway. And I mentioned this to a sober Franciscan, and they're very rare. And he said, that's your disease talking to you in such a nice, reasonable voice. You know? And the disease can talk in such a nice, reasonable voice. I do think of drinking. I'm thinking of running away from home. The trick I've learned, and I learned this very early, was I can always drink tomorrow. I don't drink today. I can always drink tomorrow. And that takes the pressure off. There's some other things I can do tomorrow too, and it takes the pressure off. But today I want real simple stuff going on. I try to be useful. I participate in meetings. I help set up chairs. I sponsor a couple of people. I try to return phone calls within 24 hours. I think that's really good. And every so often I don't. And it's 36 hours, but then I call out of shame because I'm embarrassed. But it's someone I didn't really like all that much. You know? And I ask God for help. God, as I understand God, is active and present in lots of places. And surely present at meetings. And let me end with just talking about the spiritual experience. Again, quoting my sponsor, Terry. He was a terrible drunk. Periodic. Way beyond desperate. Sent to treatment again. He went up to Schicksal in Seattle. And the theory there is the reason you drink is you're having a good time. We're going to make it a bad time. So take this chemical, and what's your favorite drink? And you give them, and then they give you this chemical, and you have your alcohol, and you vomit and shit yourself. And they'll have that. They'll have you do that six times, and that's one treatment. And you'll do that for 3 weeks. So clearly, by the end of that, you'll never want to drink again, right? So Terry went back and stayed sober for a while. Then he got drunk, and they sent him back. Same thing again for 3 weeks. And then he went back. He got drunk on the plane on the way there. And then he got drunk again. They finally asked him to not come back because he was a morale problem for the staff. He got to the point if he saw the color of bourbon or smelled that he would throw up and poop. So he learned to put it in a brown paper bag and hold his nose. And when I heard that, I loved him. This is my guy. Whew. And then, miracle of miracles, he's gets sober, goes to meetings. And he was at a meeting in New York, and he said there was this guy with 6 months sobriety at the meeting, a guy named Ralph. And Ralph was getting an acknowledgement like we did tonight for people with periods of sobriety. And Ralph got his little coin and he said, I'm so happy I get to be sober. You get to be sober. I'm so happy. And Terry's response was joy. When you feel joy when someone else is getting well, you're spiritually alive. Well, I'd like the burning bush in Moses. You're not going to get that one. You get to rejoice with someone with 10 days, 30 days, a year. We had a guy Tuesday night in Oakland where I go every Tuesday at 6:30, just got 5 years. And I wanted to run up and lick his face. Don't do that. This is boundary violation. And there are other ways you can show appreciation, you know, than scaring these poor new people to death. God, I got licked at that meeting. I'm never going back. But we get to be alive. Coming here tonight just to share some stuff. If there was anything that's useful, please make use of it. But I go to meetings because I need to be reminded of the most basic things. Like we don't drink today. And we ask God for help. And we try to be of service. And that reminds me, therefore, that life is good. Best of times, worst of times. But life is good. Thank you.